Our next case is 72325, Belcher versus State of Nevada. We have Mr. Orm representing the appellant and Mr. Pesci representing the respondent. Ms. Blue's not here then, Mr. Pesci. I assume you'll be handling the argument. Okay, very well. Thank you very much. Mr. Orm, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes, please.
Very well.
May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Orm. I'm the attorney for Norman Belcher. I'd really like to concentrate on two issues before the Court this morning or this afternoon. The first is Mr. Belcher's conviction and sentence of death should be reversed because there was a Fifth Amendment violation here. I'll get right to the point. I think that the case was, or the issue was so well briefed below that we can sort of narrow it down. There's a lot of, it seems, concessions by both sides of what occurred. But what the issue before the Court is Mr. Belcher in custody at the time he makes that statement, the incriminating statements? And I want to start off with something. The State did not argue at any time harmless error here. It wasn't argued below. As I see the Court's ruling in D'Angelo Carroll, the Court considered that there was error and was it harmless. And so I want to address that first of all with the Court right now. It can't be considered harmless. The vast majority of the evidence against Mr. Belcher came as a result of his statement. And when I say that, what they were able to do is prove things such as, you said that you were never on that side of town, yet now we have the patrol officer who's ID'd you, is giving you a traffic ticket, so that proves you're lying about that. The fact that you claim you weren't near the burning car and somebody stole your car and now we can see you on video and it's being identified as you on video, that this incriminates you. And that is the facts of what really harmed Mr. Belcher have been presented in the briefs. This can't be harmless error. There is no physical evidence linking him to the crime scene. Additionally, the only eyewitness that I can recall having any emphasis in this case was the person who was shot, Nicholas Bradham, who originally said, I was outside of the home. And then two, apparently there's a dispute about this, two masked men were involved in this. His girlfriend or his significant friend, Ashley Riley, said, oh no, we were upstairs in the bedroom, and he came out. The reason I say that is because he originally identifies the perpetrators as wearing ski masks. Now in the hospital, he says, okay, there's Mr. Bates.
I thought Nick identified Belcher as the person who shot him.
He did. He identified him in the hospital. Originally, he had stated to the police it was masked men, although he claims he didn't remember that. And he also stated that he was outside of the house and came in, as opposed to Ashley Riley, his friend, who said that they were both in bed and he had been playing on the computer. So there was a vast difference in the identification. And the reason I say that, Justice Hardesty, is not to dispute whether this was a good identification or not for purposes of argument one, but simply to show that the evidence, the strong evidence, I could attack that as, hey, you said it was a ski mask, you don't really know what you're talking about. So what I'm not trying to inform the court there's the identification is false, it doesn't mean anything. I think it was something that went to the jury. But the evidence against Mr. Belcher that was strong came as a result of the statement.
But didn't the defense concede that Belcher had gotten rid of the car because he was concerned about losing his license? And in the absence of his statement to the police, which largely denied any culpability for the car, they still would have had evidence of the traffic ticket, evidence of the arson, and the witness as it related to the car only. So in the absence of the statement, some of that's coming in. So how do you temper that?
Well, Your Honor, how is that relevant? In other words, I see what the court is saying. He was stopped on the 215, and he was given a traffic ticket. What gives that perspective is Mr. Belcher's statement, I never got a traffic ticket. I don't know what you're talking about. And the traffic ticket was within a couple of miles of the murder, and shortly thereafter, I think within 30 minutes of the murder. So if Mr. Belcher makes no statement, so what, he got a traffic ticket?
Well, it's not completely benign because Mr. Pastorino says he's in an ongoing feud with Mr. Belcher.
That's true.
Who had threatened this child, who ended up getting killed that night. So it's not completely benign, like there's a guy with a traffic ticket somewhere nearby. Must be the perp.
No, but it makes it much worse when you're having to defend your client's statement wherein he stated, I didn't get that traffic ticket. And as you may recall, on video when they're bringing the patrol officer in, he covers his face. And so, I mean, clearly a jury is going to wonder, what are you covering your face? You know, what are you scared of? And because it's the state's contention then that he got that traffic ticket shortly after the murder and within a few miles of the murder. And so I think his denial really harmed him. And that's what they did throughout his statement. And so if I could come back to the original point is he's in custody. And as I look at this case, this court has really analyzed this pursuant to Silva and to D'Angelo Carroll. One thing that the state will not touch in the briefs, will not touch, is both Mr. Silva and Mr. Carroll went to the police station, just like Mr. Belcher. What's the big difference? Mr. Belcher's handcuffed for 45 minutes. Now, I come up with 45 minutes because I know it's at least 45 minutes, and it may be a lot longer. According to the detective that arrived at the Siegel Suites, he said that Mr. Belcher had been handcuffed for approximately, or was there for 10 or 15 minutes handcuffed before he begins to take him to homicide. He said the trip to homicide lasted 30 minutes. He then takes him up to the interview room, and then he unhandcuffs him. So at a minimum, I have 40 minutes where Mr. Belcher is in handcuffs. And the standard is, would a reasonable person feel free to leave? Because remember, while he's in handcuffs, he says, can I have an attorney? I don't want to talk to you. Can I have an attorney? That's supposed to cease everything. If Miranda has been given and he's in custody, how is he not in custody? And so one of the things that is analyzed over and over and over by the state is Silva and the factors in Carroll. But they're not handcuffed. What choice does a human being who's chained have but to follow the police? And one thing that I thought was interesting, because it was, I find myself going back and forth on how best to explain it, but I would say to the court that I would say handcuffing is a universal symbol of restraint. Universal. And what I mean by that is I thought about it. If I could take any one of the justices on this court and transplant one of you to any airport in the world or any city in the world, if you went to Burma and you were in Yangon, or you went to Thailand and you were in Koh Samui, and you were walking through the airport or walking on the street, and you saw a person in handcuffs being taken away, even if you were 8 years old at the time, I think everybody recognizes, oh, that person's in trouble. That person's in control of those other men or the women who are taking him away. And maybe he's a political prisoner, maybe he's a drug dealer, maybe he's something. But he's not free to leave. I don't think anybody would say, well, I don't know why the guy in handcuffs doesn't ask, why can't I leave? Nobody would think that. And so it seems like a universal symbol of custody. And the state never explains it, nor do they want to touch it. In their analysis of Carroll and of Silva, they won't touch the fact that he's handcuffed. They keep saying, look at Carroll. Carroll was brought down there, but he was at work. Whereas Mr. Belcher was at the Siegel Suites, his apartment, handcuffed and taken. And as I look at...
Assuming that we agree with you that he was in custody, there might have been error. Can you address, Justice Steglitz addressed briefly, but can you get into the harmless error analysis here?
Sure.
Why it's not harmless?
If we take away his statement, and if I took away his statement and asked the prosecutor, Mr. Pesci, very fine prosecutor, make a closing argument now. Now is much more limited. He has trace evidence tying Mr. Belcher to the crime scene, nor with all the forensics that they do, is there anything from the crime scene traced to his Siegel Suite or to his person. We have that there was an arson, but we don't really know who or why. I think once the statement comes in, yes, there is a concession that it's done for the traffic ticket or because he's worried about his license, which I think was very, very, had to be compelling to the jury, that may not make a lot of sense, that you're burning your car to avoid what happened in a traffic ticket. It would be a lot better if that statement wasn't coming in, and there's an argument, well, we don't even really know who's doing it. So what do we really have that links Mr. Belcher? Well, they didn't really have anything. Justice Hardesty, you brought up that there was the identification, which was weak. But again, I don't want to get into the realm of saying nobody would believe that, although I think it's very skeptical that a person could say, I was outside the house, I came in, I saw two masked men, There's a dispute over this. I don't remember what I originally said to the police because I was under all this medication, but now I know it's Bates.
Wasn't the identification weeks later? And wasn't it after news of Mr. Belcher's arrest had already been public?
Yes, and it was also at a hospital where there were allegations made by the defense that other people could be present and could be making statements that, hey, it's Bates that, or excuse me, Mr. Belcher that has done this. So yes, that existed. But back to the original point, Justice Perry-Gary, I'm not sure that there was a lot. In fact, if I'm reading this record, what really ties Mr. Belcher to this crime? There was a dispute, but you remember they had the alternate suspect of Raven, who the detectives gave an alibi to and said, oh no, he was at his house. What links him? They don't find this TV. The police did lie to Mr. Belcher and said, hey, there was a witness who wrote down your license plate number. It wasn't true. It was deceptive. And I would like to take the time
to this argument, Mr. Oram, I inferred from your argument that the state waived harmless error. Mm-hmm. Is that your contention?
They didn't raise it, but I'm always skeptical to say that because I know this court, can make considerations, and so that's why I wanted to address that with the court, because I don't think they know that they can't get around it, but I want to make sure that when a decision comes out that I have at least addressed this, if this is something the court is considering.
But what about the Polk case where the state didn't raise harmless error, and that was taken, that took the analysis off the table?
Well, then that should be the application. But in the event that this court was considering it, it was something that caused me concern. As I was getting ready for this case, I recognized the state hadn't done that.
There's nothing with the state that this is harmless error.
I don't see that in their brief at all. And so what I did see was the state arguing, this court in Carroll addressing it. And this court found error, but then found it harmless. So that is why I really wanted to address that with the court. But I'm just trying to extinguish any argument the state would have or the court would have that this was harmless. It isn't harmless. And some of the factors that I thought were, I wrote these down to be applied within the analysis this court did of D'Angelo Carroll. He was handcuffed, and this is all Mr. Belcher, 40 minutes prior to getting to the interview room. His ID, his apartment key, and his phone was taken at home. So unlike Carroll, how could he make a phone call? He can't go anywhere. What can he do? He's in handcuffs, and then he's in a locked police station with the room locked. Where is he going to go? How could a reasonable person feel free to leave? He was not interrogated at the residence, which this court in D'Angelo Carroll pointed out. Well, why couldn't they have interviewed him at the Palomino Club? They could have done that. Well, why couldn't they interview this man at Siegel Suites? Because we know why. Because they wanted to take him down to the police station because it's more intimidating. He asked to leave on two occasions. He said, I want to leave. And I thought that was interesting because on page, I believe, 51, he says, I want to leave. And they tell him, well, they don't say sit tight like Carol. They just say, hold on a second. I'm just going to go get somebody. And he goes, well, how long am I going to be in here? And they say 5 or 10 minutes. They then lock the door and leave. When they come back, he's sleeping. That's how long after. He's sleeping at that point. And then they have the patrol officer come in, take a look at him. He hides his head, makes some more incriminating statements. And so how long was he free to leave at that point? He was locked in a room when the attorneys weren't present. He asked for an attorney before arriving at homicide. And when he said that to the detective, he said, I asked for an attorney. I didn't want to talk to you before we arrived. And the detective said, well, you're not under arrest. Cops lied to him repeatedly, at least 3 times that I could tell, over the same subject. It's over. Somebody saw you, a witness, a neighbor saw your license plate, wrote it down, thought the car was suspicious. It wasn't true. He was there 1 hour and 43 minutes being detained before the interview begins.
So when did he ask for the attorney?
Well, Justice Gibbons, it's hard to ascertain exactly when it happened because there's no recording. What we know is that he says in the interview to the detective, he said, I asked for an attorney before we got here, words to the effect. I have cited to where it happens in the transcript. I asked for an attorney. I didn't want to talk to you. The detective doesn't say, no, that's not true. He just simply says, you're not under arrest. which is essentially like a adoptive admission that that's exactly what you've done beforehand because it's not heard on the transcript. And I think he says words to the effect of before I got here. So he's asked for an attorney while he's in handcuffs being transported. 3.5 hours in the homicide room. 1 hour, it appears, that he is locked in the room, says, I want to leave, and then they bring the patrol officer. So he can't leave for an hour. Searching residence simultaneously. While they're doing this, they get a warrant, they're searching his residence. They arrest him 2 hours into the interview. The defendant covered his face. It's a small room, as the court analyzed in Carroll. This is a small room, one door. I think we've probably all seen interview rooms, and he couldn't get out. I mean, I suppose he could try to forcefully get out, but the detective admitted the detective was closest to the door, and he was farthest away from the door. State brief, here are two interesting things. In a subsequent brief, in a subsequent motion, the state actually wrote, now they defeated the motion to suppress, and they actually wrote in a subsequent brief, well, the defendant was in custody. And so I pointed that out. They were very upset about that, the briefs. They said, oh, you've taken that out of context. I said, well, maybe I did. But you said he was in custody, and that's because that's what an average person would think. And why do I know that's what an average person would think? Because this morning I also pulled the patrol officer who testified in this case before the Honorable Judge Bonaventure, and he said, they asked him, why did you go to homicide? And he said, I went to homicide to identify the guy they had in custody. They all thought it was custody, because that's what it is. You can't have a person handcuffed for 45 minutes before arriving at the police station and say he's not in custody. How would a reasonable person feel free to leave? With the last 3.5-4 minutes I have for the initial part of my argument, I'd like to also go to the penalty phase very briefly. In the penalty phase, as the state points out, Mr. Belcher was uncooperative. And so, just so that I don't have to hear this, he would not cooperate with mitigation. So if somebody says he wouldn't cooperate with mitigation, he would not cooperate with mitigation. He was not coming to court. I don't want to participate in this. I've told my family not to do this. I know this. I understand this. And he didn't want to come. And the court did what I would say was a valid, or tried to, you know, canvass him and make sure you understand. You could make allocution. I'm not coming. I don't want to participate in this nonsense. Okay? The defense then calls a witness, Dr. Reutemann, who does an excellent job explaining why the defendant wants death. 3 times he said, I interviewed the defendant. The defendant wants death. And he articulated why he wants death. He doesn't want to be, you know, with other inmates. He doesn't want racial issues. He doesn't want to be a soldier, a racial soldier in some kind of race riot. He thinks he's worried about harming other inmates. So he has real reasons why he should be sentenced to death. And that's what they presented. And they asked for one mitigator, and that is he has 3 kids. They didn't find that. What they found was he wants death, and then proceeded to give it to him. As I look at Mazin, that is a complete breakdown in the adversarial process. In Mazin, this court noted that had defense attorney not presented any evidence.
Mr. Orham, in the absence of an evidentiary hearing where the lawyers say what they're thinking, Mr. Belcher tells us what conversations he had, how can we actually evaluate that claim? Even though maybe it is an attorney might say, I might have handled that differently or not, you know, taken that gamble that in asking for death, they'd show him and give him life. How can I evaluate that, whether that's a strategic reason that was with the consent of the defendant or thought of in the absence of this being a post-conviction proceeding?
Your Honor, I'll read directly from Mazin, which I think answers that question. That is a question I was prepared for. I recognize because usually the argument before this court from the state, and a lot of times I've seen decisions from the court where the court is, take this up in post-conviction. Let's hear what counsel has to say. In Mazin, and I'm quoting from the 1984 decision, Mazin's cause would have been far better served without the benefit of counsel's presentation during the penalty phase, skipping a sentence, in fairness. An evidentiary hearing before the district court as to the motives or strategy behind defense counsel's performance, therefore, is not necessary in the case because they found that there was a complete breakdown. This court found there was a complete breakdown that presenting evidence in a fashion that has no benefit to the defendant doesn't need an evidentiary.
But what if those claims made on his behalf were true? What if that's what he told the person? I'd rather die than have life in prison.
Yes, that's true. And you know, Your Honor, during a lot of capital cases, you'll hear defendants say some peculiar things. And some of those things you don't want presented because they're not helpful to you. They're harmful to you.
Well, if that's not what you want.
Well, I don't see a point in presenting evidence that the man should die.
What if that's his choice? What if he would prefer, if he's going to go down, that he has death instead of life? Then whose decision is that?
Your Honor, I think that is a very interesting question. I actually briefed that in the reply and thought quite thoroughly about that. If that was the standard, shouldn't there, just like a guilty plea, be a canvas with the defendant? By the way, you don't want to be present. If I could just proceed. Okay. If you want to die and you want to present that evidence, I need to hear from you, and I need to get a valid waiver. There is no waiver. There's nothing, and I put that in the reply brief. There's nothing in there suggesting that he agreed with that. And so, basically, that's no different than McCoy, although with McCoy, I don't know if the defendant actually said in McCoy versus Louisiana, do not say that I'm guilty of the three crimes. But the defense attorney did it anyway as a tactical reason to save face or to have credibility before the jury. What does this do? We have absolutely no canvas of the defendant, and the jury bought it hook, line, and sinker. Oh, there's a good reason to execute him, and we're going to execute him. So there's no canvas. So I think it would be a very bad standard. In other words, I don't think defense attorneys would ever be abusive. But imagine, you know, I don't think it's uncommon that a defendant either is uncooperative or won't participate. I remember within the last 6 months, I've already had the case denied in front of this court, but I remember in State of Nevada versus Nunnery, I was asked, although it was not my case, did Mr. Nunnery stand up and ask the jury to sentence him to death and said he would have done it again? I had to answer to this court, yes, that's exactly what he did. But that was his choice, not his attorney's choice. And here, the defendant is not in that courtroom, and he is not being canvassed, and that is compelling evidence that would cause a death sentence. And I don't think there's a need for an evidentiary hearing by the same analysis that was done by this court in Mazin. With that, I only have 8.5 minutes left. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve
that. You may reserve that balance.
Thank you.
Mr. Pesci.
Justice Stiglitz, if I could pick up where you just were. And respectfully, in cases this large, it's hard to keep grasp of every single thing that actually happened. But I just heard that there was no canvas. Justices, I ask you to turn your attention to volume 27, specifically pages 5990 through 5992. What you have is a canvas between then District Court Judge Kadish and the defendant. And this is a canvas specifically going through this with this defendant about him not wanting to be there. Now, I grasp the concept that it might be a little bit different as far as the presentation. What does he say, page 590? As far as death row goes, I prefer to live by myself. Page 5991. I don't like having roommates. So death row is solitary. It's fine like that. And the court's asking questions, following up about that. The defendant, she even says, Judge Kadish says, well, listen, if you change your mind, if you want to come back at any point, you can come back. And he says, the defendant, 5991. All right, thank you for letting me know. But I doubt I will change. This individual made it very clear that he wanted death row, not the death penalty. Why? Why would he do that? Because he said specifically to Dr. Reutemann, he wants death row because I get a single cell. This is volume 27, pages 61, 58 through 6160. He says that he wants to have his own cell, and he says, and imagine this, he's really prophetic. He wants a defense attorney to be appointed by the state to defend him because a death verdict, he'll get one appointed. And he wants to save his family those costs. That's what he said to Dr. Reutemann. That's what Dr. Reutemann put forward. And ask yourself, could we honestly and truly say it was ineffective? And this is the most important thing I think you should turn to, which would be volume 27, page 6027. This is the mitigation verdict form. You'll see in handwriting, that means a juror added this. Quote, he wants to die. That's mitigation. That is what a juror has put forth in mitigation. If If we take what's been said as true, and Dr. Roman were not called by attorneys Modafferi and attorney Draskovich, there'd be no litigation. Zip, zilch, zero. It was, in fact, them putting on that evidence that led at least one, and who knows, maybe more, because in the mitigation context, it could be just one person or more. They didn't even check off that he has three kids. That's what defense counsel put forth, that he has three kids. The jury didn't find that to be mitigation, but they did find it to be mitigation that he said he wants to die. And you heard from defense counsel a moment ago, defendant says he didn't want to be a soldier in a race war. He didn't want to be used in some sort of a race war, that he wanted to not be a problem for other people. Anything, so many times I hear from defense attorneys, so many times, anything can be mitigation, whatever it is. And it came in through Dr. Redman, you know? And if I could kind of dovetail, because I agree with Mr. Long, arguments one and two is kind of the focus of this case, but I think it's number 15, counsel for the appellant says, we should get rid of the instruction that says hearsay and penalty is appropriate. Imagine if we do that. Just imagine for a moment. Dr. Reutman's entire testimony, well, not his entire testimony, most of it, but his entire report, volume 31, pages 6939 to 6951, which was admitted, which is rank hearsay, would never see the light of the deliberation room. You see, it cuts both ways, and we hear it so many times, and I get it. Defendants get mad that the state can introduce hearsay and penalty phase, and how are we going to defend against that? How can I defend against this? Mr. Belcher absented himself from the proceedings. How could I cross-examine that? I can't.
So why would you object to it?
We didn't. Purposely.
Exactly.
Purposely.
He's asking for the death penalty.
But isn't it a risk, though? Isn't it, Justice? I apologize. I interrupted you.
No.
It's a risk we take, right? Because, remember, I should be able to object to this. And here's why. I mean, this is the part that's so disturbing from a prosecutor's perspective. I understand we see things differently from which side we're on, right? But look at 6951. This is what Dr. Redman was able to get to this jury. Quote, he finds him, meaning Belcher, to be sincere, contrite, and humble. He hasn't allocuted the way he did. He just allocuted through a hearsay document through a doctor. What's more, he goes on and says, he's taking responsibility. Do you know how difficult that is to respond to as a prosecutor? And he just got it in without anybody cross-examining the thing. Because we have to say to ourselves, if we don't let this in, there's going to be an argument about how he couldn't put on a defense. So he was able to put on that defense. And let's look at Mazin really fast before we pivot to D'Angelo Caro. In Mazin, which was cited in the briefs, specifically, this court back in 1984 says, during the penalty stage of the trial, Mazin's counsel had the opportunity and obligation to present any evidence of mitigating circumstances. He chose instead to harshly berate the jury for returning its guilty verdict during the prior phase. Now here's what's really important. Counsel neither presented any witnesses nor substantially argued any mitigating considerations on his client's behalf. But we have Dr. Reutman. We have his report. We have him being Belcher painted as contrite and taking responsibility. And what you look at more is in the footnote in Mazin, they have the, you, your honors, the court, has the actual quote of what the defense attorney said. Mazin's counsel called the jury's verdict of guilty, quote, the greatest act of irresponsibility that I have ever seen, quote, if you are the conscience of this community, then I am ashamed to be a member of it. If you people favor the death penalty, if you people are considering the death penalty today, is the day for it. Well, because someone was actually being executed that day. Does this make you happy? Would you like to see Mazin up there instead of Bishop? He was the one actually being executed. Well, there is not a thing that I can do to prevent you from doing that. We have instead two defense attorneys who put on witnesses, who put on evidence, and who said, quote, stop the killing. They didn't say kill him.
Mr. Pesci, do you think we should be reaching this on direct appeal in any event?
No, I don't think it rises to that level. And I apologize if I didn't articulate that. I apologize because I'm so wound up. It's because this falls so short of Mazin that it should not be handled on direct appeal. And if I could pivot, unless there are more questions on that one, to D'Angelo Caro. So I think there's been an argument that we have waived harmless error analysis, and my response is no, because we've cited to Carroll. Carroll references harmless error analysis, and I'm going to now try to explain to you why harmless error doesn't even apply, because we don't even have to get to harmless error analysis in this particular case. What's so telling in Carroll, Your Honors said specifically, when the court deemed D'Angelo Carroll, who, by the way, I was one of the prosecutors on, Mr. Warren represented one of the co-defendants on, so we're kind of familiar with the case, deemed that he was in custody and suppressed his statement, and then said, this court said that there was harmless error because there was evidence to hold him to that case or tie him to it. And what's really important, though, to make sense out of this is this court said that it could not give deference to the findings of the lower court. And it took time. It says, initially, we take issue with the district court's failure to issue an order containing findings of fact and conclusions of law. Well, what did Judge Kadish do? Volume 4, pages 712 through 715. It's the findings of fact, conclusions of law. And it's thorough. It's really thorough. To the point where you've heard for, I don't know how long now, that he was in cuffs. He was in cuffs. He was in cuffs. Yes, he was in cuffs from some point at his apartment to when he was actually put into the CCDC jail cell. During the statement that the state introduced, he was not in handcuffs. But don't take my word for it. Take Judge Kadish, who actually heard the witnesses, took the testimony, and made findings. She specifically said he, quote, was not cuffed. I can see there were times that he was cuffed.
He was not cuffed when? I'm trying to get a timeline. So when he was transported to the police station, he wasn't cuffed?
My understanding, my recollection, is that when he's transported from his apartment to the police station, he's in handcuffs. I believe that that's Metro policy. I'm not sure, but I believe it is. Right. I don't think there are many detectives that want to take the risk with somebody in their car, not handcuffed. That when they're brought inside of the facility, they'll be handcuffed. When he was inside that facility, he was not handcuffed. You know, Mr. Owen just
talked. Wasn't he locked in the interrogation room?
He was in a room. He was not locked in there while the detectives were in there. There was testimony, which, by the way, Judge Kadish considered, and it's in her findings, that when the questioning occurred, he's not cuffed. When the detective stepped out, yes, the room was closed, and the explanation was, even though some people might find this crazy, they don't want someone just walking around the police station where there's evidence of other crimes and things of that nature. But when he gave that statement, he's not uncuffed. I just watched it again. He's got sunglasses on. He's so casual, he's calling the shots as to what questions he's going to answer. He says, I know, I'm not talking about my beef, as he describes it, with Billy Posterino. I'm not talking about the drug sales that I'm going to do. And the police let him. Judge Kadish made a finding in the first bite at the apple. There are two motions to suppress the statement. After Your Honors came down with D'Angelo Carroll, a second motion to suppress was filed. These attorneys were so effective, they papered this case till there were no more trees on planet Earth. We went again for a whole other hearing, and she made findings again. Volume 15, pages 3286 to 3287, plus the actual transcript, volume 15, 3280 through 3282. And she references all of the Carroll considerations, which are not new. You didn't create new law. You just applied it to that case. And she went through all those factors and then reiterated what she had already found before to say that he was not in. And this is what she says. That Mr. Belcher was told that he was his question was voluntary. He agreed to talk. He was not formally arrested. While in the room and during the entire interview, he could move about and was not cuffed. In fact, he had items in his pockets and was able to reach into his pockets when he wanted to, wore sunglasses during much of the interview, pulled the car key out of his pocket, and put gum in his mouth. Mr. Belcher voluntarily responded to questions and chose not to voluntarily respond to some questions, which he was permitted to do. The atmosphere was not police-dominated. No strong-arm tactics or deceptions were used. As there was no yelling, intimidation, or misrepresentation of the information they had. The interview itself took approximately 54 minutes.
Wasn't there some deception used as far as, and she's written here that there were no
strong arm or deceptions.
You know, Mr. Long is saying that they made representations about someone seeing his license plate. Mm-hmm. I'll take him at his word. I don't recall that, but I'll take him at his word. And let's assume for the sake of...
And that's what he's saying. So then her order would be incorrect factually if that did, in fact, come out.
I think you could argue at that particular portion of it, yes. But I think that in contrast to all the other evidence... And let's talk about that for a second, Justice Silver. Defense counsel is saying... I'm sorry. Counsel for the appellant is saying that there's nothing tying him to this other than this statement. Well, that's completely untrue. Brenda Williams... I think that the person has just been forgotten. Brenda Williams is in her house. She hears dragging noises, and she thinks, you know what? Someone's stealing my trash can again. And she looks out the window and sees a man dragging an item to a white, four-door, new car. Amazing. That's got nothing to do with his statement. We could introduce that, and we did independent of his statement. So we have a car fitting the description, a car that's burned, a car that he was in when he was given the speeding ticket. All of that evidence ties him, and we don't need a statement. We don't need him to say, no, I didn't get that, and I wasn't there. Of course that's better for us. Of course we want to use that, but we have evidence independent of his statement, without him having to make a concession because of the statement coming in, that ties him to it. The witness didn't say, I saw it was Norman Belcher. I agree with that. But she saw a man dragging items to a white, four-door, new car. That is the versa. The versa that Officer Catarici stopped him in, you don't need a statement for that evidence to come in.
When he stopped him, there was no safe and no 60-inch TV in the back that he was wrestling with in front of Ms. Williams.
That's true.
Right?
Yes.
And also, the state conceded at some point that once he asked for a lawyer, if I'm correct, well, strike that. See, I say it. The state elected not to try to introduce statements after they continued to question him after he asked for a lawyer during that interview, correct?
The state conceded to stop at page 54 of his voluntary statement where the officer came in and said, that's the guy.
Okay.
And so we, without...
But then they kept questioning him.
Yeah, I believe they did. I'm sorry. Okay. I don't know for how long, but they did.
All right.
But for, without even motion work, we indicated, we agree from this page forward, we're not going to seek to utilize. Mm-hmm. And we honored that. We stayed with that. And Counsel for the Appellants pointed that out, right? And so I don't think that changes the analysis before. What they did after, I don't think changes what they did before. And so he's there, uncuffed. He's answering what he wants. He's not answering what he doesn't want to. It's only 54 minutes. And look at D'Angelo Carroll, right? Let's point to D'Angelo Carroll, where this court said, we cannot give deference to such findings because there were none. There's findings here. There are incredible findings. And under your own case law, deference is afforded. Whether we articulated harmless error or not, it's a part of that decision, the Carroll decision. It says, we again remind the district courts of this court of their duty to enter a proper order with factual findings and legal conclusions when ruling on motions to suppress in order to facilitate appellate review. Look at the review you've got because of that being done. The trial court did not make any factual findings pertaining to the scene and action-setting circumstances surrounding the interrogation, so we, this court, cannot give deference to any such findings. The case law itself asks for that deference. The case law that we've cited, they've cited, and we've cited to the actual findings that were done. There is evidence tying this defendant to this incident, separate and distinct from his statement. And in D'Angelo Carroll...
Why didn't the state address harmless error then?
In a perfect world, we address everything. I believe defense counsel for the appellant has 17 issues, and I think our response was like over 127 pages. At some point, I think we can lose things when we refer to so many things. Of course, we should avail ourselves of everything, but we might be here all day if we did.
Mr. Pesci, just to understand the evidence against Mr. Belcher was Nick Bauman's identification, Ms. Williams' observations of the white car outside,
yes,
Mr. Belcher's statements that night to the police, there's a fourth, a girlfriend. And, I'm sorry?
Girlfriend.
Okay. What was the fourth thing?
Traffic ticket, branch car,
yeah, the
video.
Statement. Okay, the statement about the car. The car, the whole car piece. There was never any indicia of the theft found with Mr. Belcher. and no physical evidence linking him to the crime. Is that correct? Either at the crime scene or his house.
That wasn't suppressed, correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And if I could just try to dovetail with that, there's video on the back of a bar near where the car was burned. And there is an individual, I concede it's somewhat grainy, right, who walks past that area around the time of the actual burning. And two individuals, William Postorino and Nick Bradham, look at that because they're familiar with him. They've known him, Billy, for his whole life. Nick testified for about, I think he said about 30 days, and said that's his nickname was Bates. That's Bates. I know the way he's walking. I know the way he's behaving. Now, let's go back to Nick for a second, because I think at the very beginning you pointed out that Nick identifies him. He does identify him. He identifies him. He's testifying from the hospital at the preliminary hearing. He's still medicated. But what's really important is by the time he testifies at trial, and Justice Stiglitz, you pointed this out about the media, he testified, Nick Brabham that is, that he told his girlfriend as he came out of a medically induced coma, it was Bates. Before, I think actually without ever seeing his testimony, ever seeing a media story about this. So he wakes up, he's not prompted by the media, and he tells his girlfriend. That testimony comes into trial. And I understand, you know, attacking his identification, but nonetheless, we have an individual who point blank says, that person shot me, and even gives context as to how it was that this debate or discussion or problem between these two came about, which is these prescription pads for drug usage. And so we have evidence independent of his statement to directly implicate him. He was not in custody. And D'Angelo Carroll, his phone was taken from him. And I understand the appellant says, well, his phone, that being Belcher, was taken at the apartment. Okay. But D'Angelo said, I want to call. And he was told no. D'Angelo said, I want to go home. He was told no. There's none of that in these 54 minutes. He didn't ask to use the phone, he being Norman Belcher. He didn't ask to go home.
Didn't he ask to leave, and they said about 5-10 more minutes and came back an hour later with the officer?
Yes, because
so I held him for an hour.
Yeah, but that hour didn't comprise the 54 minutes of his statement. I mean, Justice Stiglitz, I agree with you. He's there all for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But the compressed version of what we introduced, that's not occurring during that time period. And so he's free to do and say what he wants, and he actually gets evidence of that because when he tells them, you know, I'm not going to talk about the drug sales, they don't do anything in response. They let him move on without having to get into that. And so
he couldn't have left the police station, though, could he? You said, yeah, I understand you can't have him roaming around Metro and all like that, but they locked him in there and he wasn't free to leave the station.
I think if he asked to leave, they'd have to leave him before Officer Cavaricci gets there and says that's the one. Because at that point, they had probable cause to arrest him. Prior to that, they do not, which is why they wait until they can get that confirmation to know this is, in fact, the person. They have information that he's tied into Nick Brabham, I'm sorry, William Postorino, but they don't know that that's him. They even have the tickets, and they have the name, but they're being cautious, and they want someone to come in and actually identify him. And think about that, because there were some arguments about it's overly suggestive. This officer made a traffic stop and indicated in testimony in a pre-trial hearing and during trial that he had 3 to 5 minutes with him, and that he, as a matter of course, as we can all probably say from our own stops by police for speeding, looked at the ID and looked at the person in front of him to be able to say this is him. And I would say, Norman Belcher is somewhat unique. He is a very light-skinned African-American with like almost blue eyes and kind of blonde hair. The officer said he remembers him. That this is the individual. So they have someone who's actually spent time with them to be able to make that identification. Hopefully that's answered all of your questions. If not, I will have a seat.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Pesci. Mr. Orton, you have a little over 8 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I would like to point out that in Carroll, this court noted, and I think this is a correct standard, however, the district court's ultimate determination of whether a person was in custody and whether a statement was voluntary will be reviewed de novo. It's for this court's decision. I think there was, I understand that the lower court does deserve deference. Also, I want to point out that with regard to the Mr. Belcher being deceived, I want to point out where that is in his statement, so if anybody wants to check that. In the ROA, it is at 557, 558, 559 through 60, and 569. During those pages, the detective talks about somebody wrote down your license plate number, and it was obviously to get him to start to be more forthright in their opinion. Another couple of things. Do you notice how they keep saying it's Metro's policy to put somebody in handcuffs? There's a very clever way. When I first saw it and I was doing the reply, I thought, wait a second, who cares whether it's their policy? Does their policy trump the Fourth Amendment? Can they simply come in and say, forget the Fourth Amendment, this is our policy? You can't just put people in handcuffs in a car and then claim that they're not in custody because that's their policy. The standard still remains, does a reasonable person in that position feel free to leave? The question that was asked about Brenda, the witness, she did see a white car, and she saw somebody dragging what looked like a big TV and putting it in the car, probably like something that's right in front of me right now. When the officer stopped Mr. Belcher, he testified, I think I would have noticed a big TV in there, and I didn't. I think he didn't want to go too far and harm the state, but there was nothing in there of any notice. And additionally, I heard Mr. Pesci bring up that Nicholas said, or Williams said, that the person at the car leaving the car where it was burning, that's Bates. Well, how does that link him to the crime? It's circumstantial evidence, but nothing linking him. They don't have anything linking him. Without a statement, you just have nothing. It's anemic. It's not that there's nothing, but it is very, very slim. So as I look at this, and I look at these factors, and I go through the factors of Carroll, if I can just do that in my last 6 minutes, you'll see that, in fact, this case is much more significant than either Carroll or Silva. The facts of it. Where was the site of the interrogation? Well, this court noted, hey, it's in Carroll, it's down at the police station. That's important. Well, that's where it is here. It also notices that, this court noticed in Carroll, that he voluntarily went down there and was told that it was voluntary. Well, that's what they try to use here, that they told Belcher it was voluntary. What's the difference? Belcher's handcuffed, and Carroll is not. Carroll's, you know, he can move his hands around. Belcher cannot. I also wonder, how would you ask to use a cell phone with your hands behind your back? How exactly does that work? I'm not quite sure how that works. And why would you ask to use your cell phone when your cell phone's on the other side of town, at least 30 minutes away? I don't think that's going to work either, and it doesn't make much sense. They lose on the side of interrogation. Then we go to the indicia of arrest, and we have the seven factors. As I go through it with Carroll, we're stronger than Carroll on every one of them. First, this court notes, although the detectives testified Carroll was not under arrest when they interrogated him, he was not handcuffed in any way. Well, here we have handcuffs. And Justice Gibbons, I noticed that the state is talking to you about when he was handcuffed and when he wasn't and when the room was locked. The standard is, would a reasonable person feel free to leave? And I'm not sure how that reasonable person for the first 45 minutes in handcuffs in a police car feels free to leave. I'm not sure how, when he says, can I leave, and then they lock him in a room for an hour, because unfortunately that's how long it took the patrol officer to get there. Does that mean he's free to leave? How would he leave? Does he do the Ted Bundy through the, how? I don't mean to be sarcastic, but some of the arguments being made don't make any sense. You can't leave a locked room in the police station. You just can't. And so you have to sit there and wait till the police officer comes in and then try to hide your face, because he's not being given his constitutional rights. So that bodes very poorly for him, as it did under Carroll. He was also, as in Carroll and noted by this court, he did ask to leave. Third, he was in a small room, just like Carroll. That's what this court noted in Carroll. He was in a small room. He was questioned. There were multiple officers. Same thing, same analysis. Then we go to four. Was he told that it was voluntary? And this court noted in four, Carroll also repeatedly asked if he could be allowed to go home. Thus, the factor weighs in Carroll's favor. So is Mr. Belcher. Can I go? Can I have an attorney? I didn't even want to talk to you people. I asked to have an attorney before I even came here. It's the same thing. Fifth, was it dominated? Police dominated? Well, of course it's police dominated. I guess SWAT first came on on the scene, and they're searching his house, and they've taken his stuff, and he's over there in handcuffs, and he's taken to the police station, he's locked in a police station. They're telling him, you're guilty of killing this child. It's obviously police-dominated. Then, the police, as sixth, as noted in Carroll, this court notes that the police deceived Mr. Carroll by saying that they had cell phone records indicating he was near the scene of the crime. That's exactly what we have here. A little different. It's saying, we've got a witness who wrote down your license plate number and you're in the same situation. Lastly, the detectives did take Mr. Carroll home, and this court noted that was in favor of the state. What did they do with Mr. Belcher? They arrested him. That's what they did. How is Mr. Belcher in any way in a different situation, not in custody? It's Silva and Carroll that had arguments that where the state could argue, are they really in custody? Here, I just don't see how, when the standard is, would a reasonable person feel free to leave? To me, it's almost comical. How can you leave that room, locked in a room? How can you leave, bless you? How can you leave when detectives are in your way? How can you leave when you're handcuffed? How can you leave when they've taken your Nevada identification? And I want to just say something in case the court sees that. During the interview, again, I was reviewing it today, he said, I've lost my driver's license. So I thought, well, how did I put in the brief that they had confiscated his identification? So I was curious how I had made that error. I went back and looked at the return of the warrant from the Siegel Suites, and it mentions that they had confiscated his Nevada identification. And so although he may have lost his driver's license, he didn't have his Nevada identification. They confiscated it. He didn't have keys to his house. How could he go anywhere? How could he leave? What could he do other than, if he was going to leave, wait for the police to give him a ride back home? With all the factors you see here, and then lastly, in Carroll, the length and form of the questioning. He's being deceived. It's a total of 5 hours. I wrote it down. This is what the district court found. He was in the room for 3.5 hours. He was in the room for 22 minutes prior to the detectives arriving. They had him locked in, so 45 minutes in handcuffs, 22 minutes in a locked door before they start interrogating, and he's already asked for a lawyer. And after he said, I want to leave, I want that lawyer again, he says it again. They lock him in a room and keep him in there for an hour. So I'm not sure how, under the standard.
Mr. Armanishan, the part where you said, I want the lawyer and all that, did the state concede that at the hearing, or is that a dispute?
No, that's not a dispute. I think it's on page 54. And we all agree. I believe it was all agreed to, and let me make sure. He says on page 50 of his statement, which I think is 575, before I got here, I asked for a lawyer, and I didn't want to talk to you. And again, it's shortly after that, again, he's saying, I want to leave. And so at that point, I don't think there's any dispute. The state didn't dispute that. I think what they did say was, essentially, after that, they wouldn't use what he said. But after that is when the patrol officer came in and made the identification. I see that my time is done. And if there are no further questions, I'll submit it to
you. Any questions from me?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Orm. Mr. Petsch, thank you for your excellent arguments, as always, with both of you. We really appreciate that. And the case will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess till 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.